As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Chapter 43 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Bassett was having a visitor. He sat in his chair while that visitor ranged excitedly up and down the room, a short, stout man, well-dressed, and with a mixture of servility and importance. The valet's first words, as he stood inside the door, had been significant. "I should like to know first if I am talking to the police." "No, and yes," Bassett said genially. "Come and sit down, man. What I mean is this. I am a friend of Judson Clark's, and this may or may not be a police matter. I don't know yet." "You are a friend of Mr. Clark's? Then the report was correct. He is still alive, sir?"
"Yes."
The valet got out a handkerchief and wiped his face. He was clearly moved. "I am glad of that, very glad. I saw some months ago in a newspaper—where is he?"
"In New York.
Now, Mellis, I've an idea that you know something about the crime Judson Clark was accused of. You intimated that at the inquest."
"Mrs. Lucas killed him."
"So she says," Bassett said easily. The valet jumped and stared. "She admits it, as the result of an accident. She also admits hiding the revolver where you found it."
"Then you do not need me."
"I'm not so sure of that." The valet was puzzled. "I want you to think back, Mellis. You saw her go down the stairs sometime before the shot. Later you were confident she had hidden the revolver, and you made a second search for it. Why? You hadn't heard her testimony at the inquest then. Clark had run away. Why didn't you think Clark had done it?"
"Because I thought she was having an affair with another man. I have always thought she did."
Bassett nodded. "I thought so. What made you think that?"
"I'll tell you. She went west without a maid, and Mr. Clark got a Swedish woman from a ranch near to look after her, a woman named Thorwald. She lived at her own place and came over every day. One night, after Mrs. Thorwald had started home, I came across her down the road near the irrigator's house, and there was a man with her. They didn't hear me behind them, and he was giving her a note for someone in the house."
"Why not for one of the servants?"
"That's what I thought then, sir. It wasn't my business. But I saw the same man later on, hanging about the place at night, and once I saw her with him, Mrs. Lucas, I mean. That was in the early evening. The gentlemen were out riding, and I'd gone with one of the maids to a hill to watch the moon rise. They were on some rocks below, in the canyon."
"Did you see him?"
"I think it was the same man, if that's what you mean. I knew something queer was going on after that, and I watched her. She went out at night more than once. Then I told Donaldson there was somebody hanging around the place, and he set a watch."
"Fine. Now we'll go to the night Lucas was shot. Was the Thorwald woman there?"
"She had started home."
"Leaving Mrs. Lucas packing alone?"
"Yes, I hadn't thought of that. The Thorwald woman heard the shot and came back. I remember that because she fainted upstairs, and I had to carry her to a bed."
"I see. Now about the revolver."
"I located it the first time I looked for it. Donaldson and the others had searched the billiard room, so I tried the big room. It was under a chair. I left it there and concealed myself in the room. She, Mrs. Lucas, came down late that night and hunted for it. Then she hid it where I got it later."
"I wish I knew, Mellis, why you didn't bring those facts out at the inquest."
"You must remember this, sir. I had been with Mr. Clark for a long time. I knew the situation, and I thought that he had gone away that night to throw suspicion from her to himself. I was not certain what to do. I would have told it all in court, but it never came to trial."
Bassett was satisfied and fairly content. After the Frenchman's departure, he sat for some time, making careful notes and studying them.
Supposing the man Melis had seen to be Clifton Hines, a good many things would be cleared up. Some new element he had to have, if Gregory's story were to be disproved, some new and different motive. Suppose, for instance... He got up and paced the floor, back and forward, forward and back. There was just one possibility and just one way of verifying it. He sat down and wrote out a long telegram, and then got his hat and carried it to the telegraph office himself. He had made his last throw. He received a reply the following day, and in a state of exhilaration bordering on madness, packed his bag, and as he packed it, addressed it, after the fashion of lonely men the world over. "Just one more trip, friend Cowhide," he said, "and then you and I are going to settle down again to work. But it's some trip, old arm-breaker." He put in his pajamas and handkerchiefs, his clean socks and collars, and then he got his revolver from a drawer and added it. Just 24 hours later he knocked at Dick's door in a boarding-house on West 9th Street, found it unlocked, and went in. Dick was asleep, and Bassett stood looking down at him with an odd sort of paternal affection. Finally he bent down and touched his shoulder. "Wake up, old top," he said. "Wake up. I have some news for you." End of chapter 43. Chapter 44 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. To Dick, the last day or two had been nightmares of loneliness. He threw caution to the winds and walked hour after hour, only to find that the street crowds, people who had left a home or were going to one, depressed him and emphasized his isolation. He had deliberately put away from him the anchor that had been Elizabeth, and had followed a treacherous memory, and now he was adrift. He told himself that he did not want much, only peace, work, and a place. But he had not had one of them. He was homesick for David, for Lucy, and with a tightening of the heart he admitted it for Elizabeth. And he had no home. He thought of Reynolds, bent over the desk in his office. He saw the quiet tree-shaded streets of the town, and Reynolds passing from house to house in the little town, doing his work, usurping his place in the confidence and friendship of the people. He saw the very children named for him asking, "Who was I named for, mother?" He saw David and Lucy gone, and the old house abandoned, or perhaps echoing to the laughter of Reynolds's children. He had moments when he wondered what would happen if he took Beverly at her word. Suppose she made her confession, reopened the thing to fill the papers with great headlines. "Judson Clark not guilty, a strange story." He saw himself going back to the curious glances of the town, never to be to them the same as before, to face them and look them down, to hear whispers behind his back, to feel himself watched and judged on that far past of his. Suppose even that it could be kept out of the papers, Wilkins, amiable and acquiescent, Beverly's confession hidden in the ruck of legal documents, and he stealing back, to go on as best he could, covering his absence with lies, and taking up his work again. But even that uneasy road was closed to him. He saw David and Lucy stooping to new and strange hypocrisies, watching with anxious old eyes the faces of their neighbors, growing defiant and hard as time went on, and suspicion still followed him. And there was Elizabeth. He tried not to think of her, save as of some fine and tender thing he had once brushed as he passed by. Even if she still cared for him, he could, even less than David and Lucy, ask her to walk the uneasy road with him. She was young. She would forget him and marry Wallace Sayre. She would have luxury and gaiety and the things that belong to youth. He was not particularly bitter about that. He knew now that he had given her real love, something very different from that early madness of his, but he knew it too late. He looked up at Bassett and then sat up. "What sort of news?" he asked, his voice still thick with sleep. "Get up and put some cold water on your head. I want you to get this." He obeyed, but without enthusiasm. Some new clue, some hope revived only to die again. What did it matter?
but he stopped by Bassett and put a hand on his shoulder. "Why do you do it?" he asked. "Why don't you let me go to the devil in my own way?" "I started this, and by heaven I've finished it," was Bassett's exultant reply. He sat down and produced a bundle of papers. "I'm going to read you something," he said. "And when I'm through, you're going to put your clothes on, and we'll go to the Biltmore. The Biltmore. Do you get it?" Then he began to read. "I, the undersigned, being of sound mind, do hereby make the following statement. I make the statement of my own free will, and swear before Almighty God that it is the truth. I am an illegitimate son of Elihu Clark. My mother, Harriet Burgess, has since married and is now known as Hattie Thorwald. She will confirm the statements herein contained. I was adopted by a woman named Hines of the city of Omaha, whose name I took. Some years later this woman married and had a daughter, of whom I shall speak later. I attended preparatory school in the East and was sent during vacations to a tutoring school owned by Mr. Henry Livingston. When I went to college, Mr. Livingston bought a ranch at Dry River, Wyoming, and I spent some time there now and then. I learned that I was being supported and sent to college from funds furnished by a firm of New York lawyers, and that aroused my suspicion. I knew that Mrs. Hines was not my mother. I finally learned that I was the son of Elihu Clark and Harriet Burgess. I felt that I should have some part of the estate, and I developed a hatred of Judson Clark, whom I knew. I made one attempt to get money from him by mail, threatening to expose his father's story, but I did not succeed. I visited my mother, Hattie Thorwald, and threatened to kill Clark. I also threatened Henry Livingston, and his death came during a dispute over the matter, but I did not kill him. He fell down and hit his head. He had a weak heart. My foster sister had gone on the stage, and Clark was infatuated with her. I saw him a number of times, but he did not connect me with the letter I had sent. My foster sister's stage name is Beverly Carlyle. She married Howard Lucas, and they visited the Clark Ranch at Narada, Wyoming, in the fall of 1911. I saw my sister there several times, and as she knew the way I felt, she was frightened. My mother, Hattie Thorwald, was a sort of maid to her, and together they tried to get me to go away. Bassett looked up. "Up to that point," he said, "I wrote it myself before I saw him." There was a note of triumph in his voice. "The rest is his." "On the night Lucas was killed, I was to go away. Bev had agreed to give me some money, for the piece had quit in June, and I was hard up. She was going to borrow it from Judd Clark, and that set me crazy. I felt it ought to be mine, or a part of it, anyhow. I was to meet my mother in the grounds, but I missed her, and I went to the house. I wasn't responsible for what I did. I was crazy, I guess. I saw Donaldson on the side porch, and beyond him were Lucas and Clark playing roulette. It made me wild. I couldn't have played roulette that night for pennies. I went around the house and in the front door. What I meant to do was to walk into that room and tell Clark who I was. He knew me, and all I meant to do was to call Bev down, and Mother, and make him sit up and take notice. I hadn't a gun on me. I swear I wasn't thinking of killing him then. I hated him like poison, but that was all. But I went into the living room, and I heard Clark say he'd lost $1,000. Maybe you don't get that. $1,000 thrown around like that, and me living on what Bev could borrow from him. That sent me wild. Lucas took a gun from him just after that and said he was going to put it in the other room. He did it, too. He put it on a table and started back. I got it and pointed it at Clark. I'd have shot him, too, but Bev came into the room. I want to exonerate Bev. She has been better than most sisters to me, and she has lied to try to save me. She came up behind me and grabbed my arm. Lucas had heard her, and he turned. I must have closed my hand on the trigger, for it went off and hit him. I was in the living room when Donaldson ran in. I hid there until they were all gathered around Lucas and had quit running in, and then I got away. I saw my mother in the grounds later. I told her where the revolver was and that they'd better put it in the billiard room. I was afraid they'd suspect Bev. I have read the above statement, and it is correct. I was legally adopted by Mrs. Alice Ford Hines of Omaha, and used that signature. I generally use the name of Frederick Gregory, which I took when I was on the stage for a short time. Signed, Clifton Hines. Bassett folded up the papers and put them in the envelope. I got that, he said, at the point of a gun, my friend. And our friend Hines departed for the Mexican border on the evening train. I don't mind saying that I saw him off. He held out for a getaway, and I guess it's just as well. He glanced at Dick, lying still and rigid on the bed. And now, he said, I think a little drink won't do us any harm. Dick refused to drink. He was endeavoring to comprehend the situation, to realize that Gregory, who had faced him with such sneering hate a day or so before, was his half-brother. Poor devil, he said at last. I wish to God I'd known. He was right, you know. No wonder. Sometime later he roused from deep study and looked at Bassett. How did you get the connection? I saw Melis and learned that Hines was in it somehow. He was the connecting link between Beverly Carlyle and the Thorwald woman. But I couldn't connect him with Beverly herself except by a chance. I wired a man I knew in Omaha, and he turned up the second marriage and a daughter known on the stage as Beverly Carlyle. Bassett was in high spirits. He moved about the room immensely pleased with himself, slightly boastful. Some little stroke, Dick, he said. What price Mr. Judson Clark tonight, eh? It will be worth $1 million to see Wilkins's face when he reads that thing. There's no mention of me as Livingstone in it, is there? It wasn't necessary to go into that. I didn't know. Look here, he exploded. You're not going to be a damned fool, are you? I'm not going to revive Judson Clark, Bassett. I don't owe him anything. Let him die a decent death and stay dead. Oh, piffle, Bassett groaned. Don't start that all over again. Don't pull any Enoch Arden stuff on me, looking in at a lighted window and wandering off to drive a taxicab. Suddenly Dick laughed. Bassett watched him, puzzled and angry, with a sort of savage tenderness. "You're crazy," he said morosely. "Darned if I understand you. Here I've got everything fixed as slick as a whistle, and it took work, believe me. And now you say you're going to chuck the whole thing." "Not at all," Dick replied, with a new ring in his voice. "You're right. I've been 10 sorts of a fool, but I know now what I'm going to do. Take up your paper, old friend, and for my sake go out and clear Judd Clark. Put up a headstone to him if you like, a good one. I'll buy it." "And what will you be doing in the meantime?" Dick stretched and threw out his arms. "Me," he said. "What should I be doing, old man? I'm going home." End of chapter 44. Chapter 45 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Lucy Crosby was dead. One moment she was of the quick, moving about the house, glancing in at David, having Minnie in the kitchen pin and unpin her veil, and the next she was still and infinitely mysterious on her white bed. She had fallen outside the door of David's room, and lay there, her arms still full of fresh bath towels, and a fixed and intense look in her eyes, as though outside the door she had come face to face with a messenger who bore surprising news. Dr. Reynolds, running up the stairs, found her there dead, and closed the door into David's room. But David knew before they told him. He waited until they had placed her on her bed, had closed her eyes, and drawn a white coverlet over her. And then he went in alone and sat down beside her and put a hand over her chilling one. "If you are still here, Lucy," he said, "and have not yet gone on, I want you to carry this with you. We are all right here. Everybody is all right. You are not to worry." After a time he went back to his room and got his prayer book. He could hear Harrison Miller's voice soothing Minnie in the lower hall and Reynolds at the telephone. He went back into the quiet chamber, and opening the prayer book, began to read aloud. "Now is Christ risen from the dead, and become the first fruits of them that slept." His voice tightened. He put his head down on the side of the bed. He was very docile that day. He moved obediently from his room for the awful aftermath of a death, for the sweeping and dusting and clean curtains, and sat in Dick's room, not reading, not even praying, a lonely yet indomitable old figure. When his friends came, elderly men who creaked in and tried to reduce their robust voices to a decorous whisper, he shook hands with them and made brief, courteous replies. Then he lapsed into silence. They felt shut off and uncomfortable and creaked out again. Only once did he seem shaken. That was when Elizabeth came swiftly in and put her arms around him as he sat. He held her close to him, saying nothing for a long time. Then he drew a deep breath. "I was feeling mighty lonely, my dear," he said. He was the better for her visit. He insisted on dressing that evening and on being helped down the stairs. The town, which had seemed inimical for so long, appeared to him suddenly to be holding out friendly hands. More than friendly hands, loving, tender hands, offering service and affection and old-time friendship. It moved about sedately, in dark clothes, and came down the stairs red-eyed and using pocket-handkerchiefs, and it surrounded him with love and loving-kindness. When they had all gone, Harrison Miller helped him up the stairs to where his tidy bed stood ready, and the nurse had placed his hot milk on a stand. But Harrison did not go at once. "What about a word to Dick, David?" he inquired awkwardly. "I've called up Bassett, but he's away, and I don't know that Dick ought to come back anyhow. If the police are on the job at all, they'll be on the lookout now. They'll know he may try to come." David looked away. Just how much he wanted Dick to tide him over these bad hours, only David knew. But he could not have him. He stared at the glass of hot milk. "I guess I can fight this out alone, Harrison," he said, "and Lucy will understand." He did not sleep much that night. Once or twice he got up and tiptoed across the hall into Lucy's room and looked at her. She was as white as her pillow and quite serene. Her hands, always a little rough and twisted with service, were smooth and rested. "You know why he can't come, Lucy," he said once. "It doesn't mean that he doesn't care. You have to remember that." His sublime faith that she heard and understood, not the Lucy on the bed, but the Lucy who had not yet gone on to the blessed company of heaven, carried him back to his bed, comforted and reassured. He was up and about his room early. The odor of baking muffins and frying ham came up the stairwell, and the sound of Mike vigorously polishing the floor in the hall. Mixed with the odor of cooking and of floor wax was the scent of flowers from Lucy's room, and Mrs. Sayre's machine stopped at the door while the chauffeur delivered a great mass of roses. David went carefully down the stairs and into his office, and there, at his long-deserted desk, commenced a letter to Dick. He was sitting there when Dick came up the street. The thought that he was going home had upheld Dick through the days that followed Bassett's departure for the West. He knew that it would be a fight, that not easily does a man step out of life and into it again, but after his days of inaction he stood ready to fight. For David, for Lucy, and, if it was not too late, for Elizabeth. When Bassett's wire came from Narada, "All clear," he set out for Haverly, more nearly happy than for months. The very rhythm of the train sang, "Going home, going home." At the Haverly station the agent stopped, stared at him, and then nodded gravely. There was something restrained in his greeting, like the voices in the old house the night before, and Dick felt a chill of apprehension. He never thought of Lucy, but David. The flowers and ribbon at the door were his first intimation, and still it was David he thought of. He went cold and bitter, standing on the freshly washed pavement, staring at them. It was all too late. David! David! He went into the house slowly, and the heavy scent of flowers greeted him. The hall was empty, and automatically he pushed open the door to David's office and went in. David was at the desk writing. David was alive. Thank God and thank God, David was alive. "David," he said brokenly. "Dear old David," and was suddenly shaken with dry, terrible sobbing. There was a great deal to do, and Dick was grateful for it. But first, like David, he went in and sat by Lucy's bed alone and talked to her. not aloud as David did, but still with that same queer conviction that she heard. He told her he was free, and that she need not worry about David, that he was there now to look after him, and he asked her, if she could, to help him with Elizabeth. Then he kissed her and went out. He met Elizabeth that day. She had come to the house, and after her custom now went up, unwarned, to David's room. She found David there, and Harrison Miller, and, it was a moment before she realized it, Dick by the mantle. He was greatly changed, she saw that, but she had no feeling of pity, nor even of undue surprise. She felt nothing at all. It gave her a curious, almost hard little sense of triumph to see that he had gone pale. She marched up to him and held out her hand, mindful of the eyes on her. "I'm so very sorry, Dick," she said. "You have a sad homecoming." Then she withdrew her hand, still calm, and turned to David. "Mother sent over some things. I'll give them to Minnie," she said, her voice clear and steady. She went out, and they heard her descending the stairs. She was puzzled to find that her knees almost gave way on the staircase, for she felt calm and without any emotion whatever. And she finished her errand so collected and poised that the two or three women who had come in to help stared after her as she departed. "Do you suppose she's seen him?" "She was in David's room. She must have." Mindful of Mike, they withdrew into Lucy's sitting room and closed the door, there to surmise and to wonder. Did he know she was engaged to Wally Sayre? Would she break her engagement now or not? Did Dick for a moment think that he could do as he had done, go away and jilt a girl and come back to be received as though nothing had happened? Because if he did... To Dick, Elizabeth's greeting had been a distinct shock. He had not known just what he had expected. Certainly he had not hoped to pick things up where he had dropped them. But there was a hard friendliness in it that was like a slap in the face. He had meant at least to fight to win back with her, but he saw now that there would not even be a fight. She was not angry or hurt. The barrier was more hopeless than that. David, watching him, waited until Harrison had gone out, and then went directly to the subject. "Have you ever stopped to think what these last months have meant to Elizabeth? Her own worries, and always this infernal town talking, talking. The child's pride has been hurt, as well as her heart." "I thought I'd better not go into that until later, he explained. "The other thing was wrong. I knew it the moment I saw Beverly, and I didn't go back again. What was the use? But you saw her face, David. I think she doesn't even care enough to hate me." "She's cared enough to engage herself to Wallace Sayre." After one astounded glance, Dick laughed bitterly. "That looks as though she cared," he said. He had gone very white. After a time, as David sat silent and thoughtful, he said, "After all, what right had I to expect anything else? When you think that a few days ago I was actually shaken at the thought of seeing another woman, you can hardly blame her." She waited a long time. Later, Dick made what was a difficult confession under the circumstances. "I know now. I think I knew all along, but the other thing was like that craving for liquor I told you about. I know now that she has always been the one woman. You'll understand that, perhaps, but she wouldn't. I would crawl on my knees to make her believe it, but it's too late. Everything's too late," he added. Before the hour for the services, he went in again and sat by Lucy's bed. But she, who had given him wise counsel so many times before, lay in her majestic peace, surrounded by flowers and infinitely removed. Yet she gave him something, something of her own peace. Once more, as on the night she had stood at the kitchen door and watched him disappear in the darkness, there came the tug of the old familiar things, the home sense. Not only David now, but the house, the faded carpet on the stairs, the old self-rocker Lucy had loved, the creaking faucets in the bathroom, Mike and Minnie, the laboratory, united in their shabby strength, they were home to him. They had come back, never to be lost again. Home. Then little by little they carried their claim further. They were not only home, they were the setting of a dream, long forgotten but now vivid in his mind, and a refuge from the dreary present.
That dream had seen Elizabeth enshrined among the old familiar things. The old house was to be a sanctuary for her and for him. From it and from her in the dream he was to go out in the morning. To it and to her he was going to come home at night after he had done a man's work. The dream faded. Before him rose the face of the morning, impassive and cool, her eyes not hostile but indifferent. She had taken herself out of his life, had turned her youth to youth and forgotten him. He understood and accepted it. He saw himself as he must have looked to her, old and worn, scarred from the last months, infinitely changed. And she was young. Heavens, how young she was! Lucy was buried the next afternoon. It was raining, and the quiet procession followed Dick and the others who carried her light body under grotesquely bobbing umbrellas. Then he and David and Minnie and Mike went back to the house, quiet with that strange emptiness that follows a death, the unconscious listening for a voice that will not speak again, for a familiar footfall. David had not gone upstairs. He sat in Lucy's sitting room in his old frock coat and black tie, with a knitted afghan across his knees. His throat looked withered in his loose collar, and there, for the first time, they discussed the future. "You're giving up a great deal, Dick," David said. "I'm proud of you, and like you, I think the money's best where it is. But this is a prejudiced town, and they think you've treated Elizabeth badly. If you don't intend to tell the story—" "Never," Dick announced firmly. "Judson Clark is dead." He smiled at David with something of his old humor. "I told Bassett to put up a monument if he wanted to. But you're right about one thing. They're not ready to take me back. I've seen it a dozen times in the last 2 days." "I never gave up a fight yet." David's voice was grim. "On the other hand, I don't want to make it uncomfortable for her. We are bound to meet. I'm putting my own feeling aside. It doesn't matter, except, of course, to me. What I thought was, we might go into the city. Reynolds would buy the house. He's going to be married." But he found himself up against the stone wall of David's opposition. He was too old to be uprooted. He liked to be able to find his way around in the dark. He was almost childish about it, and perhaps a trifle terrified. But it was his final argument that won Dick over. "I thought you'd found out there's nothing in running away from trouble." Dick straightened. "You're right," he said. "We'll stay here and fight it out together." He helped David up the stairs to where the nurse stood waiting, and then went on into his own bedroom. He surveyed it for the first time since his return with a sense of permanency and intimacy. Here, from now on, was to center his life. From this bed he would rise in the morning to go back to it at night. From this room he would go out to fight for place again, and for the old faith in him, for confiding eyes and the clasp of friendly hands. He sat down by the window, and with the feeling of dismissing them forever, retraced slowly and painfully the last few months. The night on the mountains, and Bassett asleep by the fire. The man from the cabin caught under the tree, with his face looking up, strangely twisted, from among the branches. Dawn in the alfalfa field, and the long night tramp. The boy who had recognized him in Chicago. David in his old walnut bed, shriveled and dauntless, and his own going out into the night with Lucy in the kitchen doorway, Elizabeth and Wallace Sayre on the veranda, and himself across the street under the trees, Beverly and the illumination of his freedom from the old bonds, Gregory glib and debonair telling his lying story, and later on flying to safety, his half-brother. All that, and now this quiet room with David asleep beyond the wall, and Minnie moving heavily in the kitchen below, setting her bread to rise. It was anticlimacteric, ridiculous, wonderful. Then he thought of Elizabeth, and it became terrible. After Reynolds came up, he put on a dressing gown and went down the stairs. The office was changed and looked strange and unfamiliar. But when he opened the door and went into the laboratory, nothing had been altered there. It was as though he had left it yesterday, the microscope screwed to its stand, the sterilizer gleaming and ready. It was as though it had waited for him. He was content.
He would fight, and he would work. That was all a man needed, a good fight, and work for his hands and brain. A man could live without love if he had work. He sat down on the stool and groaned. End of chapter 45. Chapter 46 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. One thing Dick knew must be done and got over with. He would have to see Elizabeth and tell her the story. He knew it would do no good, but she had a right to the fullest explanation he could give her. She did not love him, but it was intolerable that she should hate him. He meant, however, to make no case for himself. He would have to stand on the facts. This thing had happened to him. The storm had come, wrought its havoc, and passed. He was back to start again as nearly as he could where he had left off. That was all. He went to the Wheeler house the next night, passing the door twice before he turned in and rang the bell, in order that his voice might be calm and his demeanor unshaken. But the fact that Mickey, waiting on the porch, knew him, and broke into yelps of happiness and ecstatic wriggling, almost lost him his self-control. Walter Wheeler opened the door and admitted him. "I thought you might come," he said. "Come in." There was no particular warmth in his voice, but no unfriendliness. He stood by gravely while Dick took off his overcoat, and then led the way into the library. "I'd better tell you at once," he said, "that I have advised Elizabeth to see you, but that she refuses. I'd much prefer"—he busied himself at the fire for a moment—"I'd much prefer to have her see you, Livingstone. But, I'll tell you frankly, I don't think it would do much good." He sat down and stared at the fire. Dick remained standing. "She doesn't intend to see me at all?" he asked unsteadily. "That's rather out of the question if you intend to remain here. Do you?" "Yes." An unexpected feeling of sympathy for the tall young man on the hearthrug stirred in Walter Wheeler's breast. "I'm sorry, Dick. She apparently reached the breaking point a week or two ago. She knew you had been here and hadn't seen her, for one thing." He hesitated. "You've heard of her engagement?" "Yes." "I didn't want it," her father said drearily. "I suppose she knows her own business, but the thing's done. She sent you a message," he added after a pause. "She's glad it's cleared up, and I believe you are not to allow her to drive you away. She thinks David needs you." "Thank you. I'll have to stay, as she says." There was another uncomfortable silence. Then Walter Wheeler burst out. "Confound it, Dick, I'm sorry. I've fought your battles for months, not here but everywhere. But here's a battle I can't fight. She isn't angry. You'll have to get her angle of it. I think it's something like this. She had built you up into a sort of a superman. And she's, well, I suppose purity is the word. She's the essence of purity. Then, Leslie told me this tonight, she learned from him that you were back with the woman in the case in New York." And as Dick made a gesture, "There's no use going to him. He was off the beaten track, and he knows it. He took a chance to tell her for her own good. He's fond of her. I suppose that was the last straw." He sat still, a troubled figure, middle-aged and unhandsome and very weary. "It's a bad business, Dick," he said. After a time, Dick stirred. "When I first began to remember," he said, "I wanted whiskey. I would have stolen it if I couldn't have got it any other way. Then, when I got it, I didn't want it. It sickened me. This other was the same sort of thing. It's done with." Wheeler nodded. "I understand. But she wouldn't, Dick." "No, I don't suppose she would." He went away soon after that, back to the quiet house and to David. Automatically he turned in at his office, but Reynolds was writing there. He went slowly up the stairs. Anne Sayre was frankly puzzled during the next few days. She had had a week or so of serenity and anticipation, and although things were not quite as she would have had them, Elizabeth too impassive, and even Wallie rather restrained in his happiness, she was satisfied. But Dick Livingstone's return had somehow changed everything. It had changed Wallie, too. He was suddenly a man, and not, she suspected, a very happy man.
He came back one day, for instance, to say that he had taken a partnership in a brokerage office, and gave as his reason that he was sick of playing round. She rather thought it was to take his mind off something. A few days after the funeral she sent for Dr. Reynolds. "I caught cold at the cemetery," she said, when he had arrived and was seated opposite her in her boudoir. "I really did," she protested, as she caught his eye. "I suppose everybody is sending for you to have a chance to talk."
"Just about."
"You can't blame us. Particularly you can't blame me. I've got to know something, Doctor. Is he going to stay?"
"I think so. Yes."
"Isn't he going to explain anything? He can't expect just to walk back into his practice after all these months, and the talk that's been going on, and do nothing about it."
"I don't see what his going away has to do with it. He's a good doctor and a hard worker. When I'm gone..."
"You're going, are you?"
"Yes. I may live here and have an office in the city. I don't care for general practice. There's no future in it. I may take a special course in nose and throat."
But she was not interested in his plans.
"I want to know something, and only you can tell me. I'm not curious like the rest. I think I have a right to know. Has he seen Elizabeth Wheeler yet? Talked to her, I mean?"
"I don't know. I'm inclined to think not," he added cautiously.
"You mean that he hasn't?"
"Look here, Mrs. Sayre, you've confided in me, and I know it's important to you. I don't know a thing. I'm to stay on until the end of the week, and then he intends to take hold. I'm in and out, see him at meals, and we've had a little desultory talk. There is no trouble between the two families. Mr. Wheeler comes and goes. If you ask me, I think Livingstone has simply accepted the situation as he found it."
"He isn't going to explain anything? He'll have to, I think, if he expects to practice here. There have been all sorts of stories."
"I don't know, Mrs. Sayre."
"How is Dr. David?" she asked after a pause.
"Better. It wouldn't surprise me now to see him mend rapidly."
He met Elizabeth on his way down the hill, a strange, bright-eyed Elizabeth, carrying her head high and a bit too jauntily, and with a sort of hot defiance in her eyes. He drove on thoughtfully. All this turmoil and trouble, anxiety and fear, and all that was left a crushed and tragic figure of a girl, and two men in an old house preparing to fight that one of them might regain the place he had lost. It would be a fight. Reynolds saw the village already divided into two camps, a small militant minority aligned with Dick and David, and a waiting, not particularly hostile, but intensely curious majority, who would demand certain things before Dick's reinstatement in their confidence. Elizabeth Wheeler was an unconscious party to the division. It was, in a way, her battle they were fighting, and Elizabeth had gone over to the enemy. Late that afternoon Anne Sayre had her first real talk with Wallie since Dick's return. She led him out onto the terrace, her shoulders militant and her head high, and faced him there. "I can see you are not going to talk to me," she said, "so I'll talk to you. Has Dick Livingstone's return made any change between Elizabeth and you?"
"No."
"She's just the same to you? You must tell me, Wallace. I've been building so much." She realized the change in him then more fully than ever, for he faced her squarely and without evasion. "There's no change in her mother, but I think you and I will both have to get used to this. She's not in love with me. She doesn't pretend to be."
"Don't tell me it's still that man."
"I don't know." He took a turn or two about the terrace. "I don't think it is, Mother. I don't think she cares for anybody that way, certainly not for me. And that's the trouble." He faced her again. "If marrying me isn't going to make her happy, I won't hold her to it. You'll have to support me in that, Mother. I'm a pretty weak sister sometimes." That appeal touched her as nothing had done for a long time. "I'll help all I can if the need comes," she said, and turned and went heavily into the house. End of chapter 46. Chapter 47 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. David was satisfied. The great love of his life had been given to Dick, and now Dick was his again.
He grieved for Lucy, but he knew that the parting was not for long, and that from whatever high place she looked down she would know that. He was satisfied. He looked on his work and found it good. There was no trace of weakness nor of vacillation in the man who sat across from him at the table or slammed in and out of the house after his old fashion. But he was not content. At first it was enough to have Dick there, to stop in the doorway of his room and see him within, occupied with the prosaic business of getting into his clothes or out of them, now and then to put a hand on his shoulder, to hear him fussing in the laboratory again, and to be called to examine divers and sundry smears to which Dick attached impressive importance and more impressive names. But behind Dick's surface cheerfulness he knew that he was eating his heart out. And there was nothing to be done, nothing. Secretly David watched the papers for the announcement of Elizabeth's engagement, and each day drew a breath of relief when it did not come. And he had done another thing secretly, too. He did not tell Dick when her ring came back. Annie had brought the box without a letter, and the incredible cruelty of the thing made David furious. He stamped into his office and locked it in a drawer with the definite intention of saving Dick that one additional pang at a time when he already had enough to bear. For things were going very badly. The fight was on. It was a battle without action. Each side was dug in and entrenched and waiting. It was an engagement where the principals met occasionally on the neutral ground of the streets, bowed to each other, and passed on. The town was sorry for David and still fond of him, but it resented his stiff-necked attitude. It said, in effect, that when he ceased to make Dick's enemies his, it was willing to be friends. But it said also to each other and behind its hands that Dick's absence was discreditable, or it would be explained, and that he had behaved abominably to Elizabeth. It would be hanged if it would be friends with him. It looked away, but it watched. Dick knew that when he passed by on the streets, it peered at him from behind its curtains and whispered behind his back. Now and then he saw, on his evening walks, that line of cars drawn up before houses he had known and frequented, which indicated a party, but he was never asked. He never told David. It was only when the taboo touched David that Dick was resentful, and then he was inclined to question the wisdom of his return. It hurt him, for instance, to see David give up his church and reading morning prayer alone at home on Sunday mornings, and to see his grim silence when some of his old friends were mentioned. Yet on the surface things were much as they had been. David rose early, and as he improved in health, read his morning paper in his office while he waited for breakfast. Dr. Reynolds had gone, and the desk in Dick's office was back where it belonged. In the mornings Mike oiled the car in the stable and washed it, his old pipe clutched in his teeth, while from the kitchen came the sounds of pans and dishes and the odor of frying sausages. And Dick splashed in the shower and shaved by the mirror with the cracked glass in the bathroom. But he did not sing. The house was very quiet. Now and then the front door opened and a patient came in, but there was no longer the crowded waiting-room, the incessant jangle of the telephone, the odor of pungent drugs and antiseptics. When, shortly before Christmas, Dick looked at the books containing the last quarter's accounts, he began to wonder how long they could fight their losing battle. He did not mind for himself, but it was unthinkable that David should do without, one by one, the small luxuries of his old age, his cigars, his long and now errandless rambles behind Nettie. He began then to think of his property, his for the claiming, and to question whether he had not bought his peace at too great a cost to David. He knew by that time that it was not fear but pride which had sent him back empty-handed, the pride of making his own way. And now and then, too, he felt a perfectly human desire to let Bassett publish the story as his vindication, and then snatch David away from them all, to some luxurious haven where, that was the point at which he always stopped, where David could pine away in homesickness for them. There was an irony in it that made him laugh hopelessly. He occupied himself then with ways and means, and sold the car. Reynolds, about to be married and busily furnishing a city office, bought it, had it repainted a bright blue, and signified to the world at large that he was at the Rossiter house every night by leaving it at the curb. Sometimes, on long country tramps, Dick saw it outside a farmhouse and knew that the boycott was not limited to the town. By Christmas, however, he realized that the question of meeting their expenses necessitated further economies, and reluctantly at last they decided to let Mike go. Dick went out to the stable with a distinct sinking of the heart, while David sat in the house unhappily waiting for the thing to be done. But Mike refused to be discharged. "And is it discharging me you are?" he asked, putting down one of David's boots in his angry astonishment. "Well, then, I'm telling you you're not." "We can't pay you any longer, Mike, and now that the car's gone." "I'm not thinking about pay. I'm not going, and that's flat. Who'd be after doing his boots and all?" David called him in that night and dismissed him again, this time very firmly. Mike said nothing and went out, but the next morning he was scrubbing the sidewalk as usual, and after that they gave it up. Now and then Dick and Elizabeth met on the street, and she bowed to him and went on. At those times it seemed incredible that once he had held her in his arms, and that she had looked up at him with loving, faithful eyes. He suffered so from those occasional meetings that he took to watching for her so as to avoid her. Sometimes he wished she would marry Wallace quickly, so that he would be obliged to accept what now he knew he had not accepted at all. He had occasional spells of violent anger at her, and of resentment, but they died when he checked up, one after the other, the inevitable series of events that had led to the catastrophe. But it was all nonsense to say that love never died. She had loved him, and there was never anything so dead as that love of hers. He had been saved one thing, however. He had never seen her with Wally Sayre. Then one day in the country, while he trudged afoot to make one of his rare professional visits, they went past together in Wally's bright roadster. The sheer shock of it sent him against a fence, staring after them with an anger that shook him. Late in November, Elizabeth went away for a visit, and it gave him a breathing spell. But the strain was telling on him, and Bassett, stopping on his way to dinner at the Wheelers', told him so bluntly. "You look pretty rotten," he said. "It's no time to go to pieces now when you've put up your fight and won it." "I'm all right. I haven't been sleeping, that's all." "How about the business? People coming to their senses?" "Not very fast," Dick admitted. "Of course it's a little soon." After dinner at the Wheelers', when Walter Wheeler had gone to a vestry meeting, Bassett delivered himself to Margaret of a highly indignant harangue on the situation in general. "That's how I see it," he finished. "He's done a fine thing, a finer thing by a damned sight than I'd do or any of this town. He's given up money enough to pay the national debt, or nearly. If he'd come back with it, as Judson Clark, they wouldn't have cared a hang for the past. They'd have licked his boots. It makes me sick." He turned on her. "You too, I think, Mrs. Wheeler. I'm not attacking you on that score. It's human nature. But it's the truth." "Perhaps. I don't know." "They'll drive him to doing it yet. He came back to make a place for himself again like a man. Not what he had, but what he was. But they'll drive him away, mark my words." Later on, but more gently, he introduced the subject of Elizabeth. "You can't get away from this, Mrs. Wheeler. So long as she stands off and you behind her, the town is going to take her side. She doesn't know it, but that's how it stands. It all hangs on her. If he wasn't the man he is, I'd say his salvation hangs on her. I don't mean she ought to take him back. It's too late for that if she's engaged. But a little friendliness and kindness wouldn't do any harm. You, too. Do you ever have him here?" "How can I, as things are?" "Well, be friendly anyhow," he argued. "That's not asking much. I suppose he'd cut my throat if he knew, but I'm a straight-to-the-mark sort of person, and I know this. What this house does, the town will do." "I'll talk to Mr. Wheeler. I don't know. I'll say this, Mr. Bassett. I won't make her unhappy. She has borne a great deal, and sometimes I think her life is spoiled. She is very different." "If she is suffering, isn't it possible she cares for him?" But Margaret did not think so. She was so very calm. She was so calm that sometimes it was alarming. He gave her a ring, and the other day I found it, tossed into a drawer full of odds and ends. I haven't seen it lately. She may have sent it back." Elizabeth came home shortly before Christmas, undeniably glad to be back, and very gentle with them all. She set to work almost immediately on the gifts, wrapping them and tying them with methodical exactness, sticking a tiny sprig of holly through the ribbon bow, and writing cards with neatness and care. She hung up wreaths and decorated the house, and when she was through with her work she went to her room and sat with her hands folded, not thinking. She did not think any more. Wallie had sent her a flexible diamond bracelet as a Christmas gift, and it lay on her table in its box. She was very grateful, but she had not put it on. On the morning before Christmas Nina came in, her arms full of packages and her eyes shining and a little frightened. She had some news for them. She hadn't been so keen about it at first, but Leslie was like a madman. He was so pleased that he was ordering her that sable cape she had wanted so. He was like a different man. And it would be July. Elizabeth kissed her. It seemed very unreal, like everything else. She wondered why Leslie should be so excited, or her mother crying. She wondered if there was something strange about her, that it should seem so small and unimportant. But then, what was important? That one got up in the morning and ate at intervals and went to bed at night? That children came and had to be fed and washed and tended, and cried a great deal and were sick now and then? She wished she could feel something, could think it vital whether Nina should choose pink or blue for her layette, and how far she should walk each day, and if the chauffeur drove the car carefully enough. She wished she cared whether it was going to rain tomorrow or not, or whether someone was coming or not coming, and she wished terribly that she could care for Wallie, or get over the feeling that she had saved her pride at a cost to him she would not contemplate. After a time she went upstairs and put on the bracelet, and late in the afternoon she went out and bought some wool to make an afghan. It eased her conscience toward Nina. She commenced it that evening while she waited for Wallie, and she wondered if sometime she would be making an afghan for a coming child of her own, her and Wallace Sayers. Suddenly she knew she would never marry him. She faced the future with all that it implied, and she knew she could not do it. It was horrible that she had even contemplated it. It would be terrible to tell Wallie, but not as terrible as the other thing. She saw herself then with the same clearness with which she had judged Dick. She, too, leaving her havoc of wrecked lives behind her, she, too, going along her headstrong way, raising hopes not to be fulfilled, and passing on. She, too. That evening, Christmas Eve, she told Wallie she would not marry him, told him very gently, and just after an attempt of his to embrace her. She would not let him do it. "I don't know what's come over you," he said morosely, "but I'll let you alone if that's the way you feel." "I'm sorry, Wallie. It makes me shiver." In a way he was prepared for it, but nevertheless he begged for time, for a less unequivocal rejection. But he found her, for the first time, impatient with his pleadings. "I don't want to go over and over it, Wallie. I'll take the blame. I should have done it long ago." She was gentle, almost tender with him, but when he said she had spoiled his life for him, she smiled faintly. "You think that now, and don't believe I'm not sorry. I am. I hate not playing the game, as you say, but I don't think for a moment that you'll go on caring when you know I don't. That doesn't happen, that's all." "Do you know what I think?" he burst out. "I think you're still mad about Livingstone. I think you are so mad about him that you don't know it yourself." But she only smiled her cool smile and went on with her knitting. After that he got himself in hand, and perhaps he still had some hope. It was certain that she had not flinched at Dick's name, told her very earnestly that he only wanted her happiness. He did not want her unless she wanted him. He would always love her. "Not always," she said with tragically cold certainty. "Men are not like women. They forget." She wondered, after he had gone, what had made her say that. She did not tell her family that night. They were full of their own concerns. Nina's coming maternity, the wrapping of packages behind closed doors, the final trimming of the tree in the library. Leslie had started the phonograph, and it was playing Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. Still night, holy night, and only in her was there a stillness that was not holy. They hung up their stockings valiantly as usual, making a little ceremony of it, and being careful not to think about Jim's missing one. Indeed, they made rather a function of it, and Leslie demanded one of Nina's baby socks and pinned it up. "I'm starting a bank account for the little beggar," he said, and dropped a gold piece into the toe. "Next year, old girl." He put his arm around Nina. It seemed to him that life was doing considerably better than he deserved by him, and he felt very humble and contrite. He felt in his pocket for the square jeweler's box that lay there. After that, they left Walter Wheeler there to play his usual part at such times and went upstairs. He filled the stockings bravely, an orange in each toe, a box of candy, a toy for old time's sake, and then the little knick-knacks he had been gathering for days and hiding in his desk. After all, there were no fewer stockings this year than last. Instead of Jim's, there was the tiny one for Nina's baby. That was the way things went. He took away, but also he gave. He sat back in his deep chair and looked up at the stockings, ludicrously bulging. After all, if he believed that he gave and took away, then he must believe that Jim was where he had tried to think him, filling a joyous, active place in some boyish heaven. After a while he got up and went to his desk, and getting pen and paper, wrote carefully, "Dearest, you will find this in your stocking in the morning when you get up for the early service, and I want you to think over it in the church. It is filled with tenderness and with anxiety. Life is not so very long, little daughter, and it is no time to waste in anger or bitterness. A little work, a little sleep, a little love, and it is all over. Will you think of this today?" He locked up the house and went slowly up to bed. Elizabeth found the letter the next morning. She stood in the bleak room, with the ashes of last night's fire still smoking, and the stockings overhead, not festive in the gray light, but looking forlorn and abandoned. Suddenly her eyes, dry and fiercely burning for so long, were wet with tears. It was true, it was true. A little work, a little sleep, a little love. Not the great love, perhaps, not the only love of a man's life. Not the love of yesterday, but of today and tomorrow. All the fierce repression of the last week was gone. She began to suffer. She saw Dick coming home, perhaps high with hope that whatever she knew she would understand and forgive. And she saw herself failing him, cold and shut away, not big enough nor woman enough to meet him halfway. She saw him fighting his losing battle alone, protecting David but never himself, carrying Lucy to her quiet grave, sitting alone in his office while the village walked by and stared at the windows. She saw him gaining harbor after storm and finding no anchorage there. She turned and went half blindly into the empty street. She thought he was at the early service. She did not see him, but she had once again the thing that had seemed lost forever, the warm sense of his thought of her. He was there, in the shadowy back pew, with the grill behind it through which once insistent hands had reached to summon him. He was there with Lucy's prayer book in his hand, and none of the peace of the day in his heart. He knelt and rose with the others. O God, who makest us glad with the yearly remembrance of the birth of thy Son. End of chapter 47. Chapter 48 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. David was beaten, most tragic defeat of all, beaten by those he had loved and faithfully served. He did not rise on Christmas morning, and Dick, visiting him after an almost untasted breakfast, found him still in his bed and questioned him anxiously. "I'm all right," he asserted. "I'm tired, Dick, that's all. Tired of fighting. You're young. You can carry it on and win. But I'll never see it. They're stronger than we are." Later he elaborated on that. He had kept the faith. He had run with courage the race that was set before him. He had stayed up at night and fought for them, but he couldn't fight against them. Dick went downstairs again, and shutting himself in his office, fell to pacing the floor. David was right. The thing was breaking him. Very seriously now he contemplated abandoning the town, taking David with him and claiming his estate. They could travel then. He could get consultants in Europe. There were baths there and treatments. The doorbell rang. He heard Minnie's voice in the hall, not too friendly, and her tap at the door. "Someone in the waiting room," she called. When he opened the connecting door, he found Elizabeth beyond it, a pale and frightened Elizabeth, breathless and very still. It was a perceptible moment before he could control his voice to speak. Then, "I suppose you want to see David. I'm sorry, but he isn't well today. He is still in bed." "I didn't come to see David, Dick." "I cannot think you want to see me, Elizabeth." "I do, if you don't mind." He stood aside then and let her pass him into the rear office. But he was not fooled at all, not he. He had been enough. He knew why she had come, in the kindness of heart. She was so little. Good heavens, a man could crush her to nothing. She had come because she was sorry for him, and she had brought forgiveness. It was like her. It was fine. It was damnable. His voice hardened for fear it might be soft. "Is this a professional visit or a Christmas call, Elizabeth? Or perhaps I shouldn't call you that." "A Christmas call? You know what I mean, the day of peace, the day. What do you think I'm made of, Elizabeth? To have you here, gentle and good and kind." He got up and stood over her, tall and almost threatening. "You've been to church, and you've been thinking things over, I know. I was there. I heard it all. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. Bosh! Peace when there is no peace. Goodwill! I don't want your peace and goodwill." She looked up at him timidly. "You don't want to be friends, then?" "No. A thousand times no," he said violently. Then, more gently, "I'm making a fool of myself. I want your peace and goodwill, Elizabeth. God knows I need them." "You frighten me, Dick," she said slowly. "I didn't come to bring forgiveness, if that is what you mean. I came..." "Don't tell me you came to ask it. That would be more than I can bear." "Will you listen to me for a moment, Dick? I am not good at explaining things, and I'm nervous. I suppose you can see that." She tried to smile at him. "A little work, a sleep, a little love. That's life, isn't it?" He was watching her intently. "Work and trouble and a long sleep at the end, for which let us be duly thankful. That's life, too. Love. Not everyone gets love." Hopelessness and despair overwhelmed her. He was making it hard for her, impossible. She could not go on. "I did not come with peace," she said tremulously. "But if you don't want it..." She rose. "I must say this, though, before I go. I blame myself. I don't blame you. You are wrong if you think I came to forgive you." She was stumbling toward the door. "Elizabeth, what did bring you?" She turned to him with her hand on the doorknob. "I came because I wanted to see you again." He strode after her, and catching her by the arm, turned her till he faced her. "And why did you want to see me again? You can't still care for me. You know the story. You know I was here and didn't see you. You've seen Leslie Ward. You know my past. What you don't know..." He looked down into her eyes. "A little work, a little sleep, a little love," he repeated. "What did you mean by that?" "Just that," she said simply. "Only not a little love, Dick. Maybe you don't want me now. I don't know. I have suffered so much that I'm not sure of anything." "Want you," he said, "more than anything on this earth." Bassett was at his desk at the office. It was late, and the night editor, seeing him reading the early edition, his feet on his desk, carried over his coffee and doughnuts and joined him. "Sometime," he said, "I'm going to get that Clark story out of you. If it wasn't you who turned up the confession, I'll eat it." Bassett yawned. "Have it your own way," he said indifferently. "You were shielding somebody, weren't you? No? What's the answer?" Bassett made no reply. He picked up the paper and pointed to an item with the end of his pencil. "Seen this?" The night editor read it with bewilderment. He glanced up.
"What's that got to do with the Clark case?"
"Nothing. Nice people, though. Know them both."
When the night editor walked away, rather affronted, Bassett took up the paper and reread the paragraph. "Mr. and Mrs. Walter Wheeler of Haverly announced the engagement of their daughter, Elizabeth, to Dr. Richard Livingston." He sat for a long time staring at it. End of chapter 48. End of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt.